All right. Today we're going to venture into bacterial and viral genetics. We'll talk about some of the general principles of the genetics of those systems. A few times throughout the semester, we will do some comparisons between eukaryotes and bacteria and viruses, particularly when we get to gene expression. That the way that they do things is different. But today it's just more laying the groundwork so you understand what's going on in bacterial systems and with viruses. Viruses are much more like eukaryotes with respect to their genetics, but we'll get into that in a bit. But first, some terminology and some tools that you need to know and how genetics is studied in bacteria. And the projector's still warming up, so we'll get there. The thing to keep in mind is with bacteria, much of the early work was done based on the ability of the bacteria to grow or its inability to grow on certain media. And so that would be involved in metabolic pathways or nutritional pathways. And so much of the early genetics was done on the synthesis of nutritional molecules or required molecules in the bacteria. So there's some of the terminology, prototrophic. That just means it's got the ability to grow on the media that you provide it. Okay? If it's oxitrophic, or it's an autotroph or oxitrope, that means that it's got one or more mutants and it needs to have some supplement in the media, okay, that it's growing on. So whether it's a liquid media, we typically, when we do genetics, we're using solid media so that we can get discrete colonies. If you've ever worked with bacteria before and you've got a petri dish with agar in it, when you see colonies that arise on the plate, each one of those colonies has arisen from a single bacterial cell. And so in bacterial genetics, we assume that all of the cells within a single colony are genetically identical, that they should have come about as a result of just binary fission, asexual reproduction of the original bacterial cell, until you get enough that they're visible as a colony. And so when bacterial geneticists do work, we tend to pick a single colony and work with that, assuming that all of the cells are in there are genetic. If a new mutation arose, it's just going to be in a relatively small number of cells within a colony. Okay? If you go in and you start scraping off multiple colonies, it becomes more variable because now each one of these colonies arose from a single individual. Now we're looking at a population as opposed to a group that was derived from a single cell. So that's why bacterial geneticists tend to use plates instead of broth, because with plates we can distinguish a colony, which should all be genetically similar. If we put those in a broth culture, all of these cells are now moving about relative to each other and we're getting a mixed population. So if you ever work for a bacterial geneticist or if you do research in my lab, the first thing that I make new students do in my lab is show me that they could get isolated colonies consistently on a plate, because if you can't do that, you're not working with a genetically defined group of cells. You're just working with a population of cells. Okay. So minimal media it's the basically the medium that you provide a cell that has the fewest nutrients in it on which the cell can still grow. And that changes for different bacteria. So the minimal media for E. coli is different than the minimal media for Haemophilus influenzae, for example, a bacterium that I work with. E. coli needs much fewer nutrients than does E. coli. And so when you study genetics, you grow the bacteria on minimal media, right? And so you're giving it the least amount possible, but it should still grow. And then you induce mutations, either chemically or with UV irradiation or by some mechanism. And then you find ones that can't grow on minimal media, but they can grow on minimal media supplemented with some other nutrient. So, for example, if we try to grow E. coli on minimal media and it normally grows okay, then we do a mutation and we find a line that can't grow on minimal media, but it can grow. So we'll say this is minimal. And you can do something called replicate plating so that these colonies would be in the same relative position. Okay, we get something like that. This is on minimal. This is on minimal plus, we'll say glucose. We'll make it an easy one. Okay. Then that suggests that this guy here, okay, this colony, it's not present on this one with the minimal media, but it does grow on minimal media if you give it glucose. Suggests that when we've induced those mutations, we've caused a mutation in something in a carbohydrate biochemical pathway that would take something like galactose and convert it to glucose. And now we actually have to give it the glucose. So that's an indication that we have a mutation. And so this is referred to as an oxitroph, this colony. It can no longer grow on the minimal media. We need to give it something else. And oxitrophs are mutations in pathways that we can still grow by supplementing the media. Okay? And at the extreme end of minimal media is complete medium, and that is you give a bacterium so much that all of the individual mutations can still grow on it. So if we had a medium that had glucose plus, you know, all 20 of the amino acids plus all the nucleotides, that would be a complete medium. Okay. So the bacterial genome, we've been talking about Mendel and dominant and recessive. Mendel doesn't mean anything in the bacterial world. Okay? And the reason for that is the vast majority of bacteria have a single large circular chromosome. So this is the bacterial cell. This is the bacterial chromosome. And actually, this isn't to scale. If we let this chromosome relax, it would be larger than the bacterial cell in which it resides, that they're twisted up like a rubber band and folded up to take up less space. But there's a single copy of this chromosome under normal conditions. As the cell gets close to dividing, there'll be two copies of the chromosome shortly before the cell divides, but there you don't have the existence of homologous pairs in bacteria. And so the law of segregation, where you've got an allele present on each of two homologs and their relationship is either dominant or recessive, doesn't play out in a bacterial gene. If you've got a gene present on the chromosome, that gene is either expressed or it's not. Okay? It's not a matter of what combination of alleles you've got. You've got effectively one copy of the gene, and it's either functioning at that time, expressed at that time, or it's not. Okay. Another thing about bacterial chromosomes, there's very, very little wasted space. Okay. And so there are very few gaps between the genes. So unlike your chromosomes where there's a lot of space and really only about 12 to 15% of your genome encodes as the encoding regions, and a bacterial chromosome, they're packed together really tightly. Okay. And again, the reason for that is you need to think in terms of the two different lifestyles of eukaryotes and prokaryotes. Talked about this the first lecture. With eukaryotes, there's a much greater investment in the individual. You go through sexual reproduction most times, and the diversity of the offspring is what matters, that you put out offspring that have variable traits so that some of them will be successful in the environment. If you're a bacterium, your objective is to replicate as quickly as you can. And the rate-limiting steps, one of the rate-limiting steps of a bacterial cell being able to produce two daughter cells is how quickly you can replicate the chromosome. And if you've got extra DNA in the chromosome that's not really doing anything but spacing out the genes, it takes you slightly longer to replicate your chromosome than a nearby neighbor that doesn't. And in the bacterial world, if you can find a way to save 5 seconds each round of replication, within a year, that makes a huge difference in terms of the total number of generations that you're able to produce as opposed to the people that couldn't save or the cells that couldn't save that 5 seconds. And so there's this trend towards genome reduction in bacteria to get rid of anything that's not needed. And so as a result, bacterial genes tend to be placed together very closely. The first bacterium to have its genome sequenced was Haemophilus influenzae, and the largest gap between genes in the Haemophilus influenzae genome is about 67 base pairs. So in terms of other genomes, or especially eukaryotic genomes, that's not much space at all, that they're packed together very tightly. Hopefully you remember from your intro biology class, one of the main differences between a eukaryote and a prokaryote is prokaryotes don't have a nuclear membrane. And, I mean, we hammer away at that there have been some recently discovered bacteria that have something that looks like a proto-nuclear membrane. But, at least for the time being, when we talk about bacteria in here, there's no membrane around the genome, and the processes of transcription and translation aren't physically separated. That in bacteria, transcription and translation happen at the same time. In eukaryotes, they're divided by the nuclear membrane. Transcription occurs in the nucleus. Translation occurs outside the nucleus. In prokaryotes, that's not the case. Or in bacteria, that's not the case. Where later in the semester, when we talk about gene regulation, I'll show you some pictures where you can actually see RNA being produced by transcription and that RNA being translated by ribosomes with a protein coming off of the ribosomes, all happening at the same time. This is just showing a bacterial cell. They treated it in such a way that the DNA relaxed. They lysed the bacterial cell at this end, and basically the DNA exploded out. So all of this sort of curly, light gray stuff that you see out here is the bacterial chromosome in a released state. So there's quite a bit of DNA that's present in the bacterial cell. There are also these circles out here that are outside the chromosome that we'll spend some time talking about too. And they're technically called episomes. I just never use the term episomes because in my world, every time that I've had to deal with them, and the vast, vast majority of times that you'll deal with them, they're referred to as plasmids. So plasmids are smaller circles of DNA that are present in the bacterial cells, but they're separate from the chromosome. And different bacterial species and strains will have different plasmids and different numbers of plasmids contained. But these have genes on them. In many cases, I'm a medical microbiologist, so the example I'll use, in many cases, bacteria that cause disease are basically a benign bacterium that has picked up a plasmid that contains either genes for toxins or genes that allow it to infect humans better. The diphtheria, the bacterium that causes diphtheria, for example, picked up the toxins that it uses from a viral infection sometime in the past. So it's got foreign genes that have infected a plasmid. And here's an example of an F factor, which is a type of episome or plasmid. And one thing that the chromosome will have and also plasmids will have are origins of replication. And that just means it's a special sequence that's used to replicate this molecule prior to the cell dividing. And so the chromosome will have at least one origin of replication. Typically, they only have one. Each plasmid will have an origin of replication as well. And on plasmids, the origin of replication determines how many copies of a single plasmid will be present in a cell. And depending on the size of the plasmid, you could have anywhere from a single gene to some of the larger plasmids have 30 or 40 genes present on them. A typical bacterial genome would be about 4 megabases. So that's 4 million base pairs. Okay. And a bacterial gene is typically about 1,000 base pairs in length. Okay. So in a typical bacterial genome, you have around 4,000 genes. So E. coli has pretty close to 4,000 genes. Salmonella has a little bit more than that. You have some that are smaller. I've mentioned Haemophilus influenzae a few times. It's got about half of the number of genes. Haemophilus influenzae, the only place you find it in nature is in the back of your throat. Okay? It's an obligate parasite of the human respiratory tract. E. coli, you can find it in a mammalian gut, so either your intestinal tract, the intestinal tract of a cow. Cows carry a lot of E. coli around. But also you can go out and find E. coli in streams or in ponds. And that's a dramatically different kind of lifestyle. The genes that E. coli needs to be able to live, you know, at a 55-degree fall day in water with nutrients not really being abundant is quite a bit different than living at a 37-degree centigrade in, you know, human gut where there's a lot of nutrients that come floating by. So as a result, E. coli needs more genes to live in those two lifestyles. Haemophilus only ever sees 37 degrees centigrade, a fair amount of iron floating by. It's pretty warm and moist in the back of your throat. So Haemophilus doesn't need the same arsenal of genes that E. coli does. So as a rule of thumb, the more variable the conditions a bacteria can live in, the more genes it's going to need, the larger its genome. The smallest genome is a mycoplasma genitalium. It's actually an organism that can cause a mild venereal disease, STD, and it's around 400 genes in its genome. I've warned you guys that there are a lot of the better scientists tend not to be really nice people. One of the guys involved in sequencing the human genome is Craig Venter. Craig Venter basically took the technology that the government developed to sequence the human genome, started his own company, and was threatening to beat the government to sequencing the genome, and then he was going to trademark the human genome so that if anybody ever wanted to do anything with the human gene, they were going to have to pay Craig Venter money. It's actually very similar to back in the 50s, the Joker attempted to trademark the alphabet, but Batman stopped him, and we all get to write letters and emails now as a result. And so what happened is Craig, the government research group and Venter's company, Solaris, reached an agreement that they would combine their information that the government paid off Solaris, basically. But Craig Venter, since then, has done a few other things, and one of the things that he wanted to do was to show that with really simple bacteria that you can entirely engineer a free-living organism. And so they took a membrane and designed a bacterial chromosome by hand. It's like, okay, this thing needs 400 genes to be able to live. Okay, let's figure out what those genes are, and we'll come up with the most efficient version of those genes, and we'll put them in a DNA synthesizer and crank them out. Except it's Craig Venter, and he's a huge asshole, and so they couldn't stop there. So they included, they used the, they put genes in where the predicted proteins, if you use the single letter amino acid code, it leaves messages in there. So they left some messages in the genome of this bacteria, basically, you know, his version of planting a flag on the moon by putting his name in the genome and Craig Venter rocks, stuff like that, in the genome. But they synthesized an entirely artificial bacterial cell. So there is a true man-made organism. When you hear things about Frankenfood and genetic engineering, typically what's happening there is you're using a pre-existing organism and you're moving in one or two genes from the outside. This is a case where they just completely synthesized a bacterial chromosome, stuck it inside of a membrane, and the thing started living and replicating itself. So that's what you need to be afraid of in life, because if you take that thing and you take the 10 strongest bacterial toxins in the world, you now have a bacterial strain that your government is very interested in. So, horizontal transfer. So another thing that's dramatically different about bacteria than is different with most eukaryotes is the vast majority of your genetics are stable from one generation to the next. We refer to vertical transmission as the DNA that you inherited from your parents. And there is vertical transmission in bacteria. When one bacterium splits into two cells, okay, that's vertical transmission, that each daughter cell should have gotten an exact replicate of the chromosome that was in the parent cell. That's vertical transmission. But what happens in horizontal transmission is, in a relatively sudden event, the bacterium acquires new DNA during its lifespan. It's not during replication. It's just hanging around, minding its own business, and all of a sudden it gets new DNA. So if I haven't already admitted it, I will readily admit to being a loser in life, and I'm far too interested in the past, in things like comic books. I've already told you guys I have every Godzilla movie on DVD, stuff like that. So, yeah. Except, just don't watch the Bad American one with Matthew Broderick. It's not worth the time. You need something good where there are twins singing, riding a giant moth. Always makes a better movie. But, so the comic book analogy, vertical transmission are the X-Men. It's stuff that you were born with. Horizontal transmission is Spider-Man. He was just hanging out. All of a sudden he gets bit. Bam, he's got new abilities. Okay? So horizontal transfer is very significant in the life of many bacteria, that all of a sudden they can acquire a plasmid or they can acquire multiple genes that get injected by a virus, and it gives them dramatic new abilities in a very short period of time. So we'll talk about the three main forms of horizontal transfer: conjugation, transformation, and transduction. So conjugation first. Conjugation is considered a pseudosexual event in the life of a bacterium. If your bacteria, this is third base in your world, but it's not an even genetic exchange, it's not a true mixing of the DNA from two parents, so it's not sexual reproduction. But what happens is there's a, let's see if we got a picture. What will happen is there's a conjugation tube that forms from one cell. Okay. And typically, the cell that can form the tube has a specialized plasmid in it. And it's really the plasmid that drives the process of conjugation. So there are genes present on this plasmid that encode the proteins needed to produce this conjugation tube. So it makes this long, thin tube. And it will connect to another cell, and then there are multiple copies of this plasmid. These copies of the plasmid twist up really tightly, and they move through the tube until they make it to the other side. So I had an old professor that used to refer to this process as swapping spit, that they would just make a tube, but it's the plasmid that goes through. This tube is far too narrow for the chromosome to go through, so the only thing being transmitted is the plasmid. Then the conjugation tube breaks down, and now this cell will replicate that plasmid, and if it comes upon another cell, it will make a conjugation tube, and the process will continue. One of the things that's really interesting about conjugation is if these two cells bump into each other later, neither one of them will make a conjugation tube that attaches to the other. That there's a recognition mechanism where a cell containing this plasmid can detect that the adjacent cell also contains the same plasmid, so it's just a waste of energy to carry out conjugation with that cell. So they preferentially select naive cells that don't have that plasmid already, and they hook up with them. And so this is what is happening here, that we've got a conjugation tube. My guess is what they're really trying to show here is that in addition to just being able to make the conjugation tube, that the plasmid also carries information that encodes these adherent structures referred to as fimbri or pili. And so conjugation is a way in which bacteria can acquire new abilities in a relatively short period of time. The one limit to conjugation is it tends to only work between fairly closely related bacteria. So you're not going to have E. coli carry out conjugation with Neisseria gonorrhea. Okay, that they have to be fairly closely related bacteria for conjugation to take place. Okay. Don't need to know that. And it's just that the terms are, you've got the donor strain, which is the one that contains the plasmid, and the recipient is the one that doesn't. If you know that terminology, you're fine. Then there is the ability to map genes on a chromosome. We talked about some ways in which gene mapping was performed in, like, Drosophila and humans. One of the ways that you can map genes present in bacteria is by allowing conjugation to take place for a certain amount of time and then stopping it and seeing which genes made it through. And especially in E. coli, what happens is when the plasmid goes through, instead of winding up, it actually linearizes. So it gets cut and it goes through as a straight line, but it always goes through the same end first. And so if you allow conjugation to take place for a while and then you throw them in the blender that breaks these tubes, then you can see which part of the DNA made it over here. The ones that made it earlier are at one end. The ones that require more time are at the other end. And you can map them based on their relative position. That's not a big concept in your life, so don't obsess about it. This is just showing how that could be done if you had the results. When if you start conjugation, how quickly you develop the ability of certain genes. And so, again, this time shows the relative position on the plasmid or episome. One of the big problems right now with conjugation is conjugation among gram-positive bacteria in mammalian hosts. It's the mechanism right now by which a large number of antibiotic resistance genes are being passed. And so what happens is there are these gram-positive bacteria, so right now that doesn't really mean anything, but ones like staph and strep, that they're related to each other, and both being gram-positive. There's a really common class of gram-positive bacteria that doesn't cause significant disease, but it's almost always present in humans and other mammals. And that bacterial strain is acting as a reservoir. It's going through conjugation and picking up plasmids that contain genes for resistance to more and more antibiotics. And then that bacterium, you know, it's not going to make you sick, so you don't have to worry about it being resistant to antibiotics, but it's a close enough relative to Staph aureus that then it hangs out with Staph aureus in, you know, your nose one day, and it carries out, it's close enough related that it can carry out conjugation with Staph aureus. It moves some of those plasmids over, and now all of a sudden you've got Staph aureus that's picked up resistance to a new antibiotic. And so when you hear MRSA in the news, that means methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. That basically means Staph aureus that's resistant to essentially all the antibiotics that we have in our arsenal. And it's becoming a bigger problem all the time. There's a new antibiotic, daptomycin, that seems to do a pretty good job with it, but it's pricey and it tends to make people that get big doses of it sick, so it's not a great alternative. But conjugation is a very common way in which these genes for antibiotic resistance are being passed. So that'll be a huge problem in your life. I'll probably be dead by then, so good luck to you guys. All right, transformation. And transformation is one that if you happen to be taking 220 now, that you guys did transformation this week, the transformation that you did is an artificial one, where we set up the conditions in the lab, we modified the bacterium for this to take place, but it's something that occurs naturally. And one of the reasons why I mentioned Neisseria gonorrhea a few minutes ago is Neisseria gonorrhea is arguably the bacterium that carries out transformation at the highest rate. And what transformation is when a bacterium picks up naked DNA from its environment. Conjugation, there's this direct cell-cell transfer through a tube. With transformation, the bacterium is sitting there. There are pieces of DNA out in its environment, and the bacterium picks them up and incorporates them into its chromosome. Okay? So that's what transformation is. The bacterium is transformed. It picks up new abilities if it can express these genes. And the bacteria that tend to be really quite good at natural transformation, one of the groups of bacteria that are among the best of these are bacteria that you would typically find in mammalian respiratory tracts. So, Neisseria gonorrhea, not in the respiratory tract, it's the one that causes the STD gonorrhea, but it's a very close relative to another bacterium, Neisseria meningitidis, that is the leading cause of bacterial meningitis among college-age adults. So when you hear about meningitis outbreaks on college campuses, it's almost always Neisseria meningitidis that causes it. It's a bacterium that lives in the back of your throat, and then you get a sinus infection or something, you get a break in the epithelial endothelial layer, it gets access to the bloodstream, spreads from the bloodstream to your central nervous system, causes a dramatic inflammation of the lining of your central nervous system, and you got about a 55-60% chance of living through it. So they do have a vaccine available for that, but it's typically not recommended until your first classmate succumbs to bacterial meningitis. There are a few reasons why that group of bacteria, so also Haemophilus influenzae that we've talked about, it's really good at transformation. Bordetella is a bacterium that lives in your throat. One species, Bordetella pertussis, causes whooping cough. But they're all associated with a very limited host range. So they're ones that would have like 2,000 genes in their genome instead of 4,000. And so you can imagine if you're a bacterium that's got a really limited number of genes, that there are times in your life in which if you're stressed, you don't have a lot of genes to play with to try to find something new, that being able to take up DNA from the environment might be a useful strategy. And so it tends to be bacteria with smaller genomes, and they also tend to have more simple cell surfaces. So they don't have really complicated sugar structures on their surface. That allows the DNA to be taken up more readily. A cell that can take up DNA is referred to as competent. And once they've taken it up, that they're referred to as a transformant. They've been transformed by taking up that DNA. And so what tends to happen is a recombination event that takes the DNA up. Most times it's linear DNA from the environment. So it's not present as a big circle or a small circle. Most times it's small linear fragments that are taken up. And it's broken down that they're out here as a double-stranded fragment, but only a single strand makes it in. The single strand is recombined into the genome, and then the complement is synthesized. Let me see if we're talking. Okay. So there was always something sort of strange about transformation that bothered people, and that was your bacterium, and if you're taking up DNA from your environment, there's no known bacterium that just produces extra DNA and shoots it outside of its cell. Okay? None has been discovered. So the only time that you would have bacterial DNA floating around is from a bacterium that had recently died. And when cells die, their membrane loses integrity, they pop, and fragments of DNA and RNA and proteins float out into the surrounding areas. So if you're a bacterium and you're stressed and you're trying to get through a situation in which life is tough, it doesn't make a lot of sense to take up DNA from something that already beat you to death, right? These bacteria held out a shorter amount of time than you did before they succumbed. So why take up DNA from a less successful individual? And so in like the last 15 years, we've gotten a better understanding of why that happens. And it goes along with something called adaptive or facilitated mutation. Okay. And when we talk about, remember, bacteria are the Borg, right? They don't care about individuals. What they care about is a member of the population has to survive, and then if one individual survives, then a couple weeks later you're back up to a few billion. So in the bacterial world, if you've got a population that's doing pretty well, if something bad happens, as long as you can get one member of your population through, the population will regenerate in a relatively short period of time. So if you get these bacteria that have relatively small genomes and all of a sudden you put them under stress, not all of them become competent. In fact, a relatively small percentage of them will become competent and start taking up DNA from their environment. In fact, what most of them do is, we've got this, now this is the chromosome, we've got this bacterium and it's getting stressed. Okay, and what this bacterium will do is its DNA polymerase, when it replicates its chromosome, will deliberately induce mutations at a much higher rate. So now it's going along and it's inducing mutations at a very high rate. And we've got a bunch of those cells that are unhappy that are doing that. Okay. Now, the vast majority of mutations that are randomly introduced will either be neutral, so there'll be no benefit or no detriment, or they'll be detrimental, especially under stressful conditions. It's highly unlikely that a random mutation will be beneficial to the organism. Okay? But A very small number of them will. Okay, so here we've got all these red ones are detrimental mutations, and this one green one down here is the beneficial mutation that will allow this bacterium to survive. Problem is, this one that was stressed out and induced a higher rate of mutation, it's also dinged up its genome with several of these detrimental mutations. So it gets one benefit, but it's putting itself at a disadvantage or maybe even making lethal mutations in these other genes. So what will happen is eventually these cells are going to die. Okay. And when they die, their membranes pop. And their DNA is fragmented. Okay. So now you get a large number of these fragments that contain the detrimental mutations and one fragment that's floating around that's got the beneficial mutation. Okay, so that's part of the population when physiologically conditions get stressful for a bacterial population. Okay, then a small number of those of the remaining cells become competent and they start taking up DNA from their environment. Okay, so say this guy grabs that one, this one grabs that one, this one grabs that one. They incorporate it into their genomes. Okay. So now these two, they're just doing transformation. They're taking up naked DNA from their environment, incorporating it into their chromosome. But this one picks up a detrimental mutation. It's not going to do well. This one picks up two detrimental mutations. So it's not going to do well. And this guy does the equivalent of winning the bacterial version of Powerball. Right? It just had a very unlikely event that happened that's beneficial in its world, and it picked up the mutation that allows it to survive that stressful condition. And so this guy's very happy. It's able to survive under those conditions. These guys all die. Eventually this DNA degrades that's out in the environment. And 45 minutes later, we've got another happy guy that now has that as a standing change in its genome. And within a few weeks, we'll have a few billion of these cells that now that condition is not stressful, that they're quite able to do it, live in it. 99.999% of the bacteria in that population probably died off during that event. But through that facilitated mutation, deliberately changing the genome at a much higher rate, coupled with transformation, it becomes much more likely that you get a very small number of individuals that represent the population and persist. And so if we propose that as a valid strategy in humans, people would rightfully go nuts because it's been a lot of effort to get you to adulthood. Why should 99.99% of you sacrifice yourself for 0.2? All of a sudden, John Cusack's trying to get on the boat and ruin all the fun, right? So sometime when we're not in class, ask me to tell you my John Cusack stories, but he's not a nice guy. But I'd rather spend time with John Cusack than Craig Venter, if I had to, slightly more. But if you're a bacterium and the individuals are just a 45-minute investment of time, then you do that. So it's that difference in the life strategy. And I'm going to hammer away at that. It's not bacteria are simple and they're inelegant. Bacteria just play by a completely different set of rules of what success is than you do. And there's you wouldn't want to take one for the team 99.99% of the time. Bacteria don't mind doing it because the way that they carry out their life strategy. So that's the condition under which transformation makes the most sense as a stress response, is if the other members of the population are mutating their genome at a very high rate to try and find the right answer to get through the stress. Oh, and then the last one is transduction. And transduction is when a Bacteria can get sick too, and they can become infected. And the most common thing that infects a bacterium is a virus. And a virus that infects bacteria are called bacteriophage. Or sometimes just phage for short. Phage means to eat. So these things, when they infect bacteria, oftentimes they cause them to pop. And so you don't get colonies that grow on a plate, or if you're growing them in a broth, when bacteria pop, the broth starts clearing out. So it looks more and more clear. So they used to think that these things were going all Pac-Man on the bacterial cells and actually eating them. What's happening is they're infecting them and causing the bacterial cells to lyse or pop. So that's how it gets its name. It's not a real bacteria eater. But what will happen is, let's see if we got a nicer picture. Here's transduction. The bacteriophage will inject its DNA into the bacterial cell. And in some cases, the bacterium, like in your cells, if a virus infects your cells, what tends to happen is the virus takes over your cells. And part of your cellular function just becomes making more copies of a virus. Okay? Viruses don't replicate like cells do. So as a medical microbiologist, I roll my eyes a few hundred times a year reading things in the mainstream media about where they confuse bacteria and viruses. There's a huge difference between bacteria and viruses and the way that they go about things. Bacteria are cell-based. Viruses aren't. Bacteria replicate by binary fission. You've got one cell, it divides in two, then you have two cells. Viruses replicate like the game Cootie, if you've ever played that, right? That there are parts of a bug, and you roll a dice, and it's been so long, I forget if one or six is good, but you got to start with the body. So you just have all these parts laying around, and you put the parts together to make a Cootie bug, and then you've got one. That's what viruses do. They infect a cell, they trick your cell into making a bunch of parts of viruses, and then they're assembled. And that's actually the terminology that we use, viral assembly, in which all these parts are put together, and then they have to leave your cell. And some of them leave kind of gently, where they just trick your cell into making a membrane bubble and they float out, and others leave pretty violently. So Ebola, one of the reasons why it's such a dramatic disease, your cells will make so many copies of the Ebola virus that eventually it just bursts open, and it has a real strong affinity for the cells that line your bloodstream. So you just start getting these ruptures in your bloodstream, and you start bleeding from every system of your body. And so the viruses get in, they replicate, then they leave your cells. But some other viruses, what they do is they're not in a hurry to replicate. And so they inject their DNA, and the DNA will just go into your genome. It will be integrated into your chromosomes. In bacteria, a viral gene can be integrated into the chromosome, and it can stay there for long periods of time without ever producing a viral infection. And so this is referred to as lysogeny. That's a G, sorry. In bacteria, it's referred to as latency in your cells. So, for example, herpes viruses. I have a DNA genome. Herpes viruses can persist inside of your cells for a long period of time. They particularly like neurons. And we're just not talking about genital and oral herpes, so human herpes virus 1 and 2. The virus that causes chickenpox, varicella zoster, is a herpes virus. So if you've had chickenpox later in life, that virus can reactivate. It goes from being latent to it starts replicating again, and it's been latent in a neuron. So now it starts infecting the neurons, and it comes back and it infects your torso. That's what causes shingles, is the same virus that gave you chickenpox when you were 9 reactivates, jumps out of your genome, and starts replicating when you're 65, and causes this very painful disease because your neurons are infected by a virus. So pretty much once you catch a herpes virus, you've got it for life because It's got a really stable DNA genome that can persist inside of your nucleus for, and you will actually replicate the viral genome while it's latent. Yep.
Is HIV the same way?
Now, well, HIV is a retrovirus, so technically it's got an RNA-based genome. When it infects you, its genome is made of RNA, but the first thing it does when it gets inside of your cell is convert that RNA genome to a more stable molecule, DNA, and then the DNA will integrate into your genome. So one of the major proteins of HIV that cause infection is called integrase, where it's the enzyme that takes the newly formed DNA version of the HIV genome and sticks it inside of your chromosome. So DNA viruses will tend to be to induce latency if they can in the host. Okay. So that's bacterial genomes. And again, keep in mind that, one more thing I need to talk about real quickly, is sometimes you can have a situation in which you have more than one copy of a gene in bacteria. And that is in bacterial chromosomes in cells that are replicating quickly. We've got a bacterial chromosome. Here's the origin of replication. Here's gene A. Here's gene B. And here's C down here. Okay. All right. The origin of replication is where the duplication of the chromosome will always start, at the origin of replication. And in most bacteria, it starts here and it goes out both directions. And in about 3 weeks, we'll talk about that mechanism in much greater detail. But what happens is you get something called a replication fork, where this is the, let me draw this in a different color for you, sorry. This red is the new chromosome that we're replicating. Okay? So after a few minutes of replication, we still have all of our existing chromosome, and these are each double-stranded DNA. Okay, we're just not talking about single strands of DNA here. We're actually talking about the chromosome itself. Okay, so we've got, after 5 minutes, after, we'll say 15 minutes, we've got this, and now we've got a copy of A that's been duplicated here. So at this point in time, in this life of a bacterial cell, and in a bacterium that's dividing every 45 minutes, it starts replicating its genome about 5 minutes after the last round of replication finished. Okay? So if this is 15 or 20 minutes in, we now have two copies of the gene A for the rest of this bacterial cell's life. It's got two copies of A because A is fairly close to the origin of replication. If we go a few minutes later, so if this is 20 minutes, then at 30 minutes, it'd be, they droop down like this. We've got A, and now we've got B. So at 35 minutes, we've got two copies of A, two copies of B. Then eventually, we'll get something that'll look like that, where we've got C, we've got A up here, we've got B over there. So shortly before the whole chromosome is replicated, we'll have two copies of all three of these genes. And this is referred to as Merrill diploidism, where part of the genome is present in two copies and part in only one copy. Okay. So the closer a gene is to the origin of replication, it has a gene dosage effect. More of that cell's life will be spent with multiple copies of a gene closer to the origin of replication than the ones further away from the origin of replication. And if you really want your head to explode, what typically happens in very fast replicating bacteria is they're already cheating and they're starting the next round of replication. And so this one would already be starting at this origin of replication before this one's been finished. So in some cases with genes very close to the origin of replication, you can have three or more copies of a gene present. But that's in rapidly dividing cells, that it takes longer to replicate the chromosome than it does for the cells to divide. So they always have multiple copies of some genes. So it's just a complicating factor of bacterial genetics that you need to be aware of. All right. Okay, so viruses. Talked a little bit about viruses, how they get in. One of the ways in which you can think about a virus functioning is the Mitsubishi automobile plant in town. If you think about a virus being like a tank, and the Mitsubishi plant is sort of a normal functioning cell, and your cell's job is it's going to make cars. Okay, is that in this analogy? That's just a normal operation of things. But now a virus comes in as a tank, and it smashes through the walls of the Mitsubishi motor plant. Some guys pop out of the tanks, and they've got a flash drive, and they run into the control room. They insert their flash drive into the computers, and now all of a sudden, instead of Mitsubishi Motors making cars, it's going to make more tanks. And so it starts making gun turrets, it starts making treads, it starts doing all this. And then on the assembly line, those get put together. And then you've got another process by which the guys in the control room are making multiple copies of the information on the flash drive. Because each one of those tanks needs a copy of the flash drive. Okay. And so they replicate the tank. Body represents proteins that are made by a virus. And the flash drive represents nucleic acids, its genome that it has to replicate. And then some point in time, guys with the flash drive climb inside of the tank. The genome is packaged inside of the viral particle. And then the tanks either, they open up a door for it to leave, or in some cases the tanks just all smash out through the walls, go out, drive along until they find another automobile plant, crash into that, and the process repeats. Okay. So when you study viruses, it's this theme and variation. Right? The virus has to get access to the host cell. It has to replicate its genome. It has to trick the host cell into making the viral proteins that are needed. They have to be assembled. The genome has to be packaged. And then the viruses have to leave. And then they start the process over again with the next cell. And as we mentioned earlier, you can have viruses that are in that active replicating phase, or you can have ones that instead just insert their DNA inside of the host cell. So this is the lysogenic cycle. This is the lytic cycle. To lyse something means to make it pop. And so lytic is a derivative of lyse. So these cells will pop because the virus is actively replicating. And so it's referred to as lysis. We already talked about transduction. And then you can use transduction to map genes. Some phages have fairly complicated viruses. Some viruses that it can't always predict how severe an infection, a viral infection, is with how much genetic information the virus had. One of the viruses that causes viral gastroenteritis, if you ever want to get me really mad, come back after a weekend where you had a fever and vomiting and diarrhea and tell me that you had the flu. Okay? I will inform you as politely as I can while biting through my lip that flu in humans is a respiratory tract infection, and what you had was viral gastroenteritis, okay, which is inflammation of the intestines and the stomach caused by a virus. In the Midwest in particular, if you're vomiting, we call that the stomach flu. It's not the flu at all. But one of the viruses that's the most common cause of you throwing up and having diarrhea for about 24 hours has 8 genes in its genome. And everything else that it's doing to you is a result of your immune system responding to that virus and its 8 genes. Most symptoms associated with viral infections are a result of your immune system killing off or attempting to kill off your cells that are infected with that virus. They're not a direct response of the virus producing toxins that are going out and doing things. Viral gastroenteritis, whenever you hear itis at the end of a disease name, it means inflammation. So your stomach, the lining of your stomach was inflamed, and your intestines were inflamed because that's where the virus was infecting, and your immune system was seeing that and saying, let's go in there and beat the crap out of those guys. And it causes inflammation that results in diarrhea and vomiting. So some viruses have very few genes, like an adenovirus. Other viruses, like the pox viruses, viruses are really big and complex, and there's very little difference between a pox virus and Mycoplasma genitalium that is a free-living thing. If basically you would give a pox virus about 4 more genes, it could be a real simple bacterium. And the pox virus is not actual size. This is to give you an idea of relative scale, are actually quite large compared to most other viruses too. So there are some that are really complex in terms of their genetics, others really basic. But one of the ways which they mapped viral genomes was looking at, some cases, the genome is injected and the viral particles stay outside the cell. So much like the conjugation studies where you would time the transfer of DNA and then disrupt it and see which point in time genes were transferred, they did that with phage DNA. And then, I already alluded to this earlier with the question from your classmate. You can have, unlike cell-based life, all the cells that we talk about, their genomes will be DNA. A significant number of viruses have RNA genomes. And the one that we talked about earlier, HIV, is a retrovirus. RNA is not a stable molecule compared to DNA. So if you're going to persist in a host cell, if you're going to go latent, you have to have a DNA genome. Or in the case of a retrovirus, you have to convert your RNA genome to a DNA genome. RNA, at best, lasts a day or two inside of a host cell. Your DNA molecules persist for the entire life of your cell. But RNA's job is to be broken, is to be synthesized, and then to be broken down. So if you're a virus and you're making RNA genomes, or you have an RNA genome, you need to replicate quickly, get into the cell, get out of the cell, package your RNA up before it starts being broken down. But if you're a DNA virus, you can take your time, take a little bit longer, and even go latent, like a herpes virus can, and persist for 60 years inside of your host. And one of the reasons why HIV can go effectively can go latent is it converts that RNA genome into a more stable DNA genome that integrates into your cells. Take medical microbiology next semester with me, and we'll talk about retrovirus structure function. And this is just showing, in 196, it's been so long since I looked over those notes, did Dr. Cook talk about alternating lives of plants where you've got, the moss or the liverwort or whatever is there and you've got it produces the one end cells and they go. And so I always hated alternating life cycles when I took biology, and virologists do the same thing. That every time that you learn about a virus, you will see a diagram that looks like this, and almost always it starts at the top with how the virus attaches to the host cell. Most specificity for why certain viruses only infect certain hosts or certain cell types within hosts is determined by what they bind to on the host surface. And it's a very specific interaction, and if you start changing this molecule much, you don't get binding. One of the interesting things about influenza is the influenza viruses that tend to make people really sick tend not to be very good at binding to the upper respiratory tract. So when people are running around screaming, oh my God, avian flu, it's going to kill us all, the people that were dying from avian flu were the guys that were cleaning the bird crap out of the chicken coops. Okay, because in birds, influenza infects the digestive tract, and then it comes out in the bird poop and it dries out. Okay? If I have influenza, okay, and I cough, That virus is covered in a bunch of mucus and snot and slime from my respiratory tract, and you've seen those pictures where somebody coughs or sneezes and you get all these droplets. But those droplets tend to settle out pretty quickly. And if you walk through my big plume o' droplets and you're laughing really hard and then you inhale, it's still very unlikely that any of those droplets make it all the way down to your lungs without touching any of the lining of your respiratory tract. So what most people don't understand is when people die from influenza, most times they're dying from a pneumonia. They're dying of an infection of the lungs. Most influenza never makes it down past your collarbone. It binds much better to the cells at the upper respiratory tract, and that makes it easier for you to pass it to the next person because you'll cough and sneeze. But with avian flu, it's much better at binding to the lungs, but it's almost impossible to get it to the lungs in a wet form. So if you've got dried out bird poop and you're sweeping, dry microparticles stay suspended much better than aerosols do. And so if that same guy, the same scenario, if now we replace my cough aerosol with dry bird poop with flu virus and he inhales it, it's much more likely that that virus gets all the way down to his lungs. So there tends to be this balance between, with influenza, being easily transmitted from person to person and actually being a life-threatening virus. And that's caused entirely by the carbohydrates that the virus binds to. They're in a slightly different configuration in your upper respiratory tract than they are in the lungs. And so it's a very unusual virus that's easy to transmit in the respiratory tract and also causes a high amount of lethality. In fact, the highest one ever measured when they've done good science behind it is about 10 to 11% lethality. That's the 1918-1919 influenza virus. But when these things still pop out, they always have exaggerated death tolls like 40%. That's because a lot of people are going to get the virus, cough three times, and get their ass back to work. And they're never part of the denominator until later they come back in and they do blood tests on the population to see who actually had the virus and what percentage of them were okay fighting it off. So viruses bind, they get inside, they replicate, and they exit. So if you start talking about viruses, get used to looking at those because that's the way they live their life. All right. So I got for you today again. When I'm home with my kid this afternoon, I will try to finish the grading and the tests and get those things posted.
Because I've never seen Godzilla 2000, but I've heard it's